Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we learn about drug repurposing in the fight against COVID-19. My guest today has worked on drug repurposing for a number of years in the fight against Castleman's disease, a fairly rare disorder of the lymphatic system. Drug repurposing is often the only way to find effective treatments for rare and novel diseases and is now in high gear with COVID-19, with both promising results, like remdesivir, or very disappointing results like hydroxychloroquine. Dr. David Fagenbaum nearly lost his life to Castleman's and has experienced this cytokine storm that's common to the most seriously ill COVID-19 patients. His work in the Castleman's Disease Collaborative Network he co-founded examined how over 1,500 FDA-approved drugs could be used effectively against Castleman's. Now with COVID-19, his University of Pennsylvania lab's focus has switched over to seeing if the same holds true for COVID-19. Dr. Fagenbaum is an immunologist at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and is one of the youngest individuals appointed to the faculty there. He's the co-founder of the Castleman's Disease Collaborative Network, was named to the Forbes 30 Under 30 list. He's written numerous scholarly papers and in medical journals and received awards for his work there and discovered the treatment that put his own case of Castleman's in remission. He's the author of a memoir titled Chasing My Cure: A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. He joins us today to talk about the use of drug repurposing in the fight against COVID-19. Dr. Fagenbaum, thanks very much for joining us. Thanks for joining us on Studio Tulsa.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Yeah, the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network that you lead has been looking at how existing medicines might prove effective at combating Castleman's, which is a fairly uncommon disorder. But as I understand it, you're now using that same approach to COVID-19. Tell us about this approach, using existing drugs and trying to find a new reuse. Is it a difficult process?
That's right, Rich. So I'm actually alive today thanks to a drug that we identified that had never been used before for Castleman disease, and I started using to treat myself. This drug was used for another condition for 30 years. This concept called drug repurposing is so important for so many diseases like COVID-19, like Castleman's and many others that have so few treatment options. We can't just focus on developing new drugs for these conditions. We have to look at all the existing drugs. Unfortunately, as you alluded to, it is a challenging process. There are a lot of reasons and a lot of incentives and disincentives in place that make it hard to do this well and to do it quickly. But it's something that we've really pushed forward and for Castleman disease because we realized that it would take 10 to 15 years to develop a new drug and take way more money than we could ever raise. And so our best bet was to best understand what is happening in Castleman disease, to profile samples, to really understand what's going wrong, and then ask the question, what drugs are already FDA approved that could maybe fix the problems that we're finding in our samples, test them out in the lab, and then give them to humans. I was the first human with my disease to ever get this drug, and I'm alive today chatting with you thanks to it.
Yeah. Now, obviously, those approaches can work towards COVID-19 today.
That's exactly right. There are 1,500 drugs that are approved for something, and many of those drugs are already being tried against COVID-19. I mentioned that I'm alive today thanks to a repurposed drug, and that gives me this incredible sense of wanting to pay it forward, to be able to apply this approach that's saving my life to other diseases. And so actually I redirected my lab and my foundation, the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, we redirected recently to focus on COVID-19, to follow the exact same approach that we took in chasing my cure, to actually try to chase after a solution for COVID-19.
Now, drug repurposing is a tricky business, as we've seen already with COVID-19, with certain drugs being tried and find that, in fact, they cause more negative outcomes than positive. Can you talk about that process of making sure that we're just not willy-nilly experimenting on people? I assume you're looking at working on the virus in a lab first, obviously, before you ever try it
That's
on
right.
a human.
That's exactly right. We have to be focused on making sure that every step is taken appropriately. So just as you said, you start working in the lab to understand what might work. You then go from test tubes to testing it in animals typically. And based on that work, then you say, okay, it's ready for prime time in humans. I think one thing that is that's maybe come to light with the really aggressive drug repurposing that's occurred right now. So typically for diseases, very little drug repurposing ever happens. There are very few incentives in place, and it's rare that drugs get tried in new ways in a typical setting. With COVID-19, there is a lot of drug repurposing happening, as you mentioned, and unfortunately, there are discussions about drug repurposing that we typically wouldn't have, or maybe even a focus that typically wouldn't occur, where typically once we start doing drug repurposing, we systematically track, is it helping, is it hurting? And based on these trials, we make really important decisions about go, no go. Because of the urgency right now with COVID-19, all of us hope so badly that these drugs work that we are looking at data before it's ready for prime time. And we're making decisions before we necessarily have all the data. So I can see how there is this urgency that exists today, but we're really trying to follow the blueprint that we laid out in our approach to make sure that we aren't skipping any steps for COVID-19.
So I know your lab has been looking at existing drugs that may prove useful. Are there many that ultimately may prove useful at this point?
There are a few promising candidates. There's one drug in particular that was actually developed for Castleman disease 30 years ago. So you mentioned earlier that I have this deadly immune system condition where my immune system gets hyperactivated and attacks my organs. Well, it's actually quite similar to what happens in COVID-19. Our immune systems get out of control, and in an attempt to control the virus, they actually destroy our healthy, normal tissue. So since there is similarities between the two diseases, we and others have been looking at drugs that were initially developed for Castleman disease to try against COVID-19. There's one drug in particular, a drug called tocilizumab, that was developed for Castleman's 30 years ago. And actually, a colleague of mine developed the drug, and he tested it on mice. And then when he was ready to give it to humans, he decided to give it to himself as the first human to prove that it was safe. And when I asked him about it, I said, "Kazu, I heard that you gave this drug to yourself to prove that it was safe." And he told me, he said, no, I didn't give it to myself. The nurse, she gave it to me. So this amazing doctor in Japan developed this drug, tocilizumab, tested it on himself, then went on to test it, get it approved for Castleman in Japan. And now it's one of the most promising agents. There was a promising trial that reported results last week. And so we're, again, trying to be disciplined and wait for all the data. But it does look like this drug could be helpful for the most sick cases of COVID-19. And this is just one example of many of drugs that are promising that are coming down the pipeline. But just as you said earlier, we have to be disciplined to look at the data in totality, to really be systematic about deciding, you know, whether these drugs should be used beyond just experimental trials.
And that antibody surge you're talking about is the cytokine storm that we've been hearing a lot about. I know you've experienced a cytokine storm yourself. What is that experience like? What's happening to your body when the body's undergoing a cytokine storm?
So one way to think about it is that when we get sick with any sort of a virus and we get a cold or the flu, and we feel really bad, we feel tired and we feel achy and we just feel bad, we often think that it's the virus that's making us feel bad. But actually, the reason we feel bad is actually all of the various molecules that are called cytokines that are being produced by your immune system to fight the virus. So it's actually you feel sick because of all the things that your immune system is making in an attempt to get rid of the virus. So it's not the virus, it's our response to the virus. And then if you take a typical cold or flu and then multiply it by 1,000 and think about how you would feel if all of those molecules that make you feel bad when you get a common cold, imagine if you multiplied it times 1,000. Those same molecules that make you feel unwell, they actually also cause organs to shut down when the levels are too high. So your liver, your kidneys, your bone marrow, your heart, your lungs, they will all begin to shut down when those cytokines get too elevated. And it's called a storm because there's basically this circuit that occurs where a little bit of cytokines lead to a lot of cytokines. And then the immune system gets totally out of control. And you feel awful. So for me, I was unconscious for most of the day. I would wake up for maybe an hour or two of the day. I was on dialysis because my kidneys were shut down. I was so confused because my kidneys and my bone marrow weren't working. So my I couldn't filter my blood. So all of my thoughts were confused because of all of the toxins accumulating in my blood. And all I could think about was that I wouldn't make it. And I knew I wouldn't make it because the doctors didn't think I would survive. And I remember as I laid on my deathbed for the first time, I didn't regret anything that I had done in my life. I regretted the things that I had not done. And so when I got out of the hospital and I survived thanks to lots of chemotherapy, I really decided that I would dedicate my life to trying to turn my hopes into action, to make sure that I took action above all, and that I could fight back against this disease. And I can only imagine the feeling that so many of these COVID-19 patients are having as they go into the cytokine storm where their brain is not working appropriately because their blood is not filtered, and they're thinking and hoping that they just get one more chance. And in our lab and others, we're doing everything we can to give them that one more chance.
How big a role is the cytokine storms playing in what ultimately leads to mortality episodes with COVID-19?
So nearly all of the deaths that are occurring right now with COVID-19 is actually due to a cytokine storm. It's actually due to this hyperactive immune response where the immune system gets too activated and it's fighting so hard against the virus that it actually causes collateral damage. That is what is so deadly about COVID-19, and it's what's so deadly about Castleman disease. So the work, what I think is so challenging about drug repurposing for COVID-19 is that some people mount an appropriate immune response. They get the virus, they control it, and they get better. Other people mount too weak of a response, meaning that they don't control the virus and they get more and more sick, but they never get a hyperactive response, so they don't die. They get very sick, but they eventually overcome it. But then this third group of people that mount too aggressive of a response against COVID-19, their immune system is just too strong, those are the patients who are dying of these cytokine storms. And so when you think about it as being so heterogeneous like that, where there's different groups, you can imagine that we'll probably need different drugs for different types of patients, and that's where it gets really, really complicated.
No. You just have to watch the evening news to see a bevy of autoimmune drugs that have been developed over the last decade or so against all sorts of autoimmune diseases, from eczema to the rheumatoid arthritis to, you know, a whole range of diseases where your body is basically attacking itself. Are these the drugs that may have some use against COVID-19 or those class of drugs?
Exactly. Each of those drugs that are in that class, these disease-modifying agents that are used in autoimmune conditions, those are the drugs that give us the most hope for the people who have that hyperinflammatory response, those people that we need to suppress the immune system down. So, yes, it's those drugs that give us the most hope. And then there's also those people that have too weak of an immune response where we need to boost up their immune system. But figuring out which patient needs what kind of drug is really one of the greatest challenges that we're facing.
My guest today is Dr. David Fagenbaum. He's an immunologist and assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and leads the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network. He wrote a book about his own experience surviving Castleman's disease, which was part of the reason that he works on Castleman's disease. It's called Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. And the CDCN, the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, is now working to repurpose drugs to work against COVID-19 as a big part of their work, which is also part of their work against Castleman as well. Well, I have to ask you, there's all sorts of information being published about COVID-19, a lot of it coming from scientific journals or even letters to the editor in which, mm-hmm. you know, doctors are saying, hey, I've seen this in my labs. But there's so much misinformation out there. It's hard to know what is factual and what is very much premature, factual information mm-hmm. that may be premature. What would you say are the most useful pieces of new information that we've learned about COVID-19, say, in the last month?
This is a really great question because the news is completely focused on COVID-19. And so there's so many different reports coming out at the same time. And as you said, sometimes reports are coming out maybe a little bit before all of the data is there. And you can understand why we're all so ready for this to be in our rearview mirror. But I think that a few of the things that I would highlight that I think are most important that have come out, the first is that it's been about 4 months, 5 months now that this virus has been in existence. And there are very, very few cases of people getting reinfected, meaning that once you get infected with the virus, it's likely that you're able to mount an immune response so that the next time you encounter it, you don't get the virus again, which is a really good thing. That's a good sign for our chances of a vaccine working. It's also a good sign for people being able to go back to work. If they've already been exposed to the virus, they likely won't get it again. No one knows for sure if that will be the case, but the fact that this much time has gone by and there are very few reports of people getting reinfected, that should give us some confidence that a vaccine should be able to work. I think that's a really important takeaway. Another important takeaway, I believe, is the fact that it's the cytokine storm, not the virus itself, that seems to be causing the harm that we're seeing and the death that we're seeing within COVID-19. That helps us to focus on making sure that we still look at antivirals, but really we also consider all of those drugs you mentioned that help to suppress or to modulate the immune system as effective therapies. And I think a third takeaway is, though no drugs to date have yet been slam dunks that just completely destroy the disease in its tracks, what we have seen is that there seem to be at least a few drugs that are having some activity against the disease, that are having some ability to control the disease, which is a really good sign, because it may be that maybe we need a cocktail where we combine multiple drugs and we give the right drug to the right patient, and then we can have a really meaningful effect. But the fact that we're seeing some weaknesses in the armor of this virus and some ways that we can control the virus with drugs gives me hope that there are cocktails or additional drugs that need to be identified, which is really what's driving us to continue to move forward. I can remember about a month ago, as I was thinking about this, you know, awful pandemic really just starting to hit the U.S., and hoping that some research group somewhere would follow the blueprint that we developed for identifying a drug that saved my life. And I even thought to myself, I hope maybe some researcher will actually read Chasing My Cure and check the boxes on the approach that we took. And I said, wait a minute, if I'm hoping and praying that someone takes our approach, then maybe I need to do it. And maybe I need to turn my hope into action, which is really kind of a underlying theme of my journey, is that we need to be hopeful and we need to be prayerful, but we need to also recognize what we're hoping for and then do what we can to make that we're hoping for turn into action and reality.
Now, you've repurposed a lot of your work towards COVID-19. How common would you say that is in research medicine today, where people are taking their approaches towards a whole range of disease and saying, oh, there could be a connection here with COVID-19, and refocusing their research? I would think that's not too common, or is it, in a pandemic?
So outside of the pandemic, it is extraordinarily rare for a research group to pivot even just a little bit. We all focus 100% on our cell types or our diseases or our class of diseases, and of course, we enjoy collaborating with others and sharing ways that we can help, but typically there's very little pivoting. With this pandemic, I have been so delighted and grateful to see so many of my colleagues, people that work in fields that maybe don't seem related at all, who are rolling up their sleeves and getting involved, who are thinking about ways their techniques and their samples and their processes could actually help against COVID-19. So it's been really amazing to see, and something that I talk about a lot and that I think is really important is that during really tough times, we're often encouraged to look for silver linings. And I think this is an example where you can say, you know what, a silver lining of this really tough time is that people are working together in ways that maybe they haven't before, or researchers are stepping outside of the box in ways that they haven't before. But I think that what's maybe even more important to note here is that these people are creating silver linings. So, you know, if they didn't redirect their lab, if they didn't basically focus their lives on this new direction, then we wouldn't make the progress that we are. And so I think that's a widespread lesson. And I think so much of my journey, unfortunately, is very relevant today. And you know, going through these cytokine storms feels relevant to what we're going through. And this concept is not just looking for silver linings, but let's create silver linings. Let's think about ways in the midst of these really tough times we can do something that can help us to make this into a positive out of something that is undeniably just such a negative.
Since I have an immunologist with me today, I have to ask about the latest drug that's being touted as a potential treatment, and that's remdesivir, which really at first glance doesn't make a lot of sense. It was actually developed for hemorrhagic fevers. But I guess if you're, again, trying to control immune response to COVID-19, maybe there is a relationship. What have you learned about this drugs at this point?
Yeah, so remdesivir is one of the few drugs that does seem to be quite promising. As you said, there are mechanisms of action that we think drugs will work in one way, and then sometimes we learn that actually they have other ways that they work. And human biology is so complicated that you might think that it works in just one way, but there's, you know, many other ways that it's involved. And so you're exactly right. This is a drug that maybe we would not have initially thought would be effective. It was actually tried against Ebola and was not effective against Ebola. But based on some of the mechanisms of this drug and what we know about COVID-19, it was proposed as a potential drug to try here. And just as you said, there's some real optimism because there was what's called a randomized controlled trial, which means that there were two groups of people, one group that got the drug, one group that didn't get the drug, and no one involved in the study, no one had any idea who was going to be put into which group. The patients didn't know, the doctors didn't know. And then they saw how did the patients do, people who got the drug and people who didn't get the drug. And what they found was that actually there were significantly fewer people who were still in the hospital or were still on ventilators that got the drug versus people who didn't get the drug. And there's a very low likelihood that could have happened by random chance, but no way it could have happened by a doctor hoping that the drug works and maybe, you know, fudging the numbers or anything. This is a randomized control trial, which is really the gold standard. So we all were really pleased to see this because it's very unlikely that it wasn't the drug and that it was something else that helped these patients. I do think that we were all hoping that maybe there would be an even bigger effect, and that, you know, everyone would be out of the hospital and everyone would be cured and no one would die. We didn't see that. Patients still died on the drug. One thing we can be hopeful about is about the timing of giving the drug. So there's two factors that could help us to improve how effective the drug is. One is figuring out when is the right time to give it. Do you need to give it very early in the course? Do you need to give it middle or late in course? What's the right timing? And secondly, who is the right kind of patient? Is it the patient who's going to have too weak of an immune response? Is the patient who's going to have too strong of an immune response? So if we can start to understand who's the right patient, then those improvements that maybe seem small across a large number could hopefully become, you know, really significant when we figure out who's the right person at the right time to get the drug.
I want to ask you about one other study that was been talked about in just a couple last days in a few scientific publications, and that's about and I'm not even sure it's a study at this point, but it was something that a cardiologist in Switzerland mentioned that he was seeing that COVID-19 is showing up attached to virtually every major organ in the body. And, you know, we've focused on COVID-19 as really a viral pneumonia type of virus that affects our lungs. And, of course, you're seeing all these strange reports of, you know, people having the virus and then having a stroke or a heart attack or some other major organ issue a few weeks after they seemingly recover. And this study suggests that maybe that COVID-19 is more than a viral pneumonia, that it attaches itself to a variety of major organs. Have you seen that study? And what does this tell us about this virus?
So I have not seen that study, but I have seen that the list of cell types that this virus can actually infect seems to be growing by the day. Early on, we thought that it only could bind to cells in your airway, so bronchial epithelial cells. But you're right. As time has gone on, researchers have been able to uncover that there are many other cell types throughout the body that this virus can infect. And in order to be able to get into a cell, you need to have basically a key or a door on the cell, which is one of these markers to get into the cell. And it turns out that marker or that door, or maybe the keyhole, is actually present on a number of cells that we didn't realize initially. So I think that it makes sense that the virus is able to get into other organs because it can get into different types of cells. And I think that what we're also seeing from this cytokine storm is that once the immune system gets turned on and it gets activated and starts producing cytokines, it loses the ability to focus on where the enemy is, and it just starts attacking everything. It's kind of like you can imagine a military analogy where a cytokine storm is kind of like friendly fire, where you're shooting at someone who's part of your team. You know, you're supposed to be a good guy, and you're shooting other good guys. But it's where that friendly fire actually gets out of control, where some friendly fire leads to more friendly fire and more friendly fire, and unfortunately causes significant damage. And so that affects every organ, whether, you know, it starts in the lung, it'll actually cause damage everywhere. And unfortunately, we don't know everything there is to know about COVID-19, which is actually kind of the place that we're in for a lot of rare diseases. There are 7,000 rare diseases that don't have any FDA-approved drugs. And so this sort of world of the unknown is a tough world to be in. But until we get these answers, we need to continue to push forward the science.
My guest today is Dr. David Fagenbaum. He's an immunologist and an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and leads the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, which is now working. They work traditionally on Castleman disease, finding existing drugs that would work against this disease of the lymphatic system. And now they've focused their attention to finding drugs already approved for various diseases and various treatments towards COVID-19. He's the author of the book, Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action, as he was actually diagnosed with Castleman's and on his deathbed at one point before recovering and devoting his life to Castleman disease research. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You mentioned earlier when you said some of the good news that we've got is that from what we've learned about the COVID-19 now, that there's good hopes for a vaccine. And already you're starting to hear optimism from respected scientists that we could have a vaccine as early as the end of the year. What is your thoughts on the hope for an early vaccine as opposed to one that would be a year to 18 months or 2 years away?
Yeah, I think that a year seems like the most reasonable time frame for this to happen. Now, if it can happen by the end of this year, so in the next 7 months, I will be so thrilled. I think all of us will be thrilled if we can get a safe and effective vaccine by the end of this calendar year. The sooner the better. One thing that I've been following a lot recently is the concept that, yes, we want to get one as soon as possible, but obviously it needs to be safe. And another concept to keep in mind is that it may be that there are going to be multiple vaccines and that one may be early and deployed just to healthcare workers who are at the highest risk of exposure to the virus. And maybe if there are some potential side effects that we wouldn't want the whole world exposed to, this vaccine would maybe just go to the frontline workers who have the risk-benefit analysis where they're at high risk. And so it's maybe worth getting that early vaccine, whereas additional vaccines will come out that maybe will be even more effective or maybe even more safe that would then be able to be given to people who are not at high risk. And obviously we want the most effective, most safe vaccine to come out as soon as possible, but it may be that there are going to be different layers of vaccine.
We have to remember in the fight against polio, it was the Salk vaccine that was first, but it was really the Sabin vaccine that most of us ended up getting in polio.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. And you know, we as a society have, and this polio was before my time, we forget the races that so many people were on to identify vaccines as quickly as possible. And we are certainly in another race right now for a vaccine.
Well, Dr. Fagenbaum, I appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us. And good luck with your own work on Castleman's disease, as well as the work you're doing to find drugs that may have some help against COVID-19. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. David Fagenbaum is an immunologist and assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and leads the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network. He's also the author of Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.